Now, the Marquette University Law School released its latest poll last week, which measured the political opinions of over 900 registered voters in Wisconsin. This was the 75th poll conducted by the law school, which started the survey back in 2012. But now the polling team is updating the way they conduct the poll to get a more reliable sample of the population, a better response rate, and hopefully more accurate results. We often talk to the director of the survey about the results of the surveys and what they tell us about state and national politics. Today we're going to talk about survey methodology itself and how his and other polls gather this important data and what's leading many pollsters to change their polling ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how polling works, how it's changed over the years? How do you think political polling could be improved? Have you ever been surveyed for your political opinions? What was that experience like? Or did you just let it ring? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's co-founder of pollster.com and founder of pollsandvotes.com. Charles, welcome back to Central Time. Now, I'm glad you picked up when we got in touch with you, Charles, but I think part of the problem that people may be wondering about when it comes to polling is people don't answer their phones as much anymore. How has that affected your polling and polling around the country?
It's been a big effect in terms of the costs of doing polls. Back in 2012, when we started the Marquette poll, we could expect about a 7% total response rate. Now, that sounds low, and it is low compared to 30 years ago when we could get a 70% response rate. But as you said, people don't answer their phone the way they used to. What that means is we simply have to dial many more numbers in order to reach our 900 respondents or so. Response rates now range from 1 to 2%, with many of them closer to 1 than to 2. And that was a problem we ran into last fall in the heat of the campaign. Our response rates dropped off, not tremendously, but some. But it meant the sheer number of hours we had to have interviewers attempting phone calls. And to put it in perspective, less than 1% of calls are answered when we first call. We will call back if a number's unanswered, but even so, we still end up with a 1.5% or so response rate. This is true throughout the industry, and it's been a big change. We're addressing that by developing these new methods, which others in the industry are also using.
Before we dig into new methods, one concern people might have, I assume pollsters might have, is, you know, if with that small response rate, if one group, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, old or young, committed political observers versus not, if one of those groups is more prone to answer the phone and the other group is less prone, could that skew results? How have you and other pollsters prior to taking on these new methods tried to make sure that didn't happen?
Yeah, that's an issue that goes way back in time, not really a function of this new lower response rate. So, for example, people with higher education are more likely to answer the phone. Older people are more likely to answer. Try getting somebody under 30 on the phone, even if you're related to them. It's not the easiest thing to do. So those things have gotten a bit worse in recent years, but they've always been an element of telephone surveys. The way we address it is to use census data that tells us the number of people under 30, over 65, the number of people with a bachelor's degree or less than a bachelor's degree. We know that for the population of Wisconsin. And so if we have too few younger people, we can weight those people up so that the weighted sample is the proper percentage of under 30s. And for the older people that are so anxious to do the interview, we weight them down a bit. So they're the right percentage of 65 and over. That works pretty well, and it can be tested and sort of demonstrated that it works pretty well. But it is a concern, especially when some groups become much less willing to respond That became more of an issue with people under 30 in the fall. We still got such people, but we didn't get as many as we were getting even a year or two ago.
Talking to Charles Franklin with Marquette University Law School poll, talking about changes in polling, how pollsters, he and others, are updating things, trying to make sure they reach who they want to reach. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about how polling works, what's changing, what isn't working. Join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, Charles, I want to lift up the hood and do a little before and after. Can you give us the broad strokes, what happened before these changes? What was the step-by-step on your poll? How you found your voters? What kind of voters you were looking for? And so on.
Sure. So the key thing is this is a random sample of registered voters in the state. You can't volunteer to do the poll. You can't sign up for it and do it five times. You have to be randomly selected. And that's the same in the old method and the new. In the old, we started with all the phone numbers in the state, both landline and cell phone, and we randomly picked the numbers to call, and that's how we generated our sample. And then we asked people if they were registered to vote or not. What we're doing now is starting with a list of all registered voters in the state. You buy that list from a company that takes the state's public registered voter and then provides it to survey groups. But we also use a separate sample based on postal delivery addresses around the state with, again, a random sample of addresses that mail is delivered to. Those folks get a U.S. Postal Service letter inviting them to take part in surveys. So what we're doing now is blending these two. About 3/4 of the respondents come from the registered voter list, and about 1/4 come from this address-based list. Put those two together, and that's our sample. But in both cases, these are registered voters, and they were sampled randomly.
Is doing a survey on the phone the only option under this new look, or are people doing this online in some cases?
Well, thankfully, it's not the only option anymore. That's one of the advantages of this shift. For the registered voter list and the address-based sample, we have email addresses for the substantial majority of people on those lists. So those folks now get an email inviting them to take part in the survey, explaining that it's Marquette doing the survey and how to participate. And it includes a unique link that can only be used once and only by the person that received the email. For the people that we don't have email for, we phone them. And so as a result, this time we did just a little over 2/3 of respondents who responded by email or online, I should say. They got the email and then they responded online for that roughly a little under 1/3 that weren't reachable by email. We phoned them. Also, if you get an invitation to participate, we will phone you if we don't hear from you fairly soon.
All right. So what was the response rate like in this first spin of the new method?
Well, the grand total is about 1.5%. But the people that do the poll from the address-based sample respond at a higher rate. The phone calls to the registered voter list, as I say, is right there in the a little better than we were doing last fall, but it's still in the 1.5% range. The total combining those two is a little bit better than what we were getting last year. But the main thing is people really like being able to do the interview online. They can do it on a smartphone, or they can do it on a tablet or a laptop, or God forbid, a desktop computer. But mostly, I think they like us not calling during dinner time.
I like my desktop computer. We're talking to Marquette Law School poll director Charles Franklin about polling methodology, updates the ways he conducts his political opinion surveys. This is happening in polls around the country as well. And coming up, we'll talk a little bit about what we do with these polls, whether it's for a a race for political office or measuring support or opposition for an issue over time, you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of political polling? Do you follow a poll, lots of polling at election time or on key issues facing the nation? What questions do you have about how it works, what we can and can't do with it? Call in at 800-642-1234. We will answer the phone when you call. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy and director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He's with us today for a look at updates, the way he conducts his survey, and changes in political polling across the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about political polling? If you've participated in a survey, we'd love to hear about your experience. Join in with your questions, your experiences, your thoughts on the value of polling. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Heard from Cynthia, who couldn't stay on the line. Cynthia says she's one of those people that never answers the phone, suggests that hey, you ought to let people know what number to expect ahead of time so they know to answer. Too many spam calls, especially when you're retired. Charles, is that part of the new system here where people maybe know that number is coming?
No. And the number is just a number. It doesn't come up on caller ID as coming from Marquette. Our phone facility is contracted out and is out of state, actually, in Pennsylvania. With the email, though, we do get around that, because now you get an email. It explains what's going on at some length, and as I said, says that this is the Marquette poll. So people do have a better ability to understand that rather than the unknown phone call. But as we all know, phone calls are really a problem these days, and lots of people are like Cynthia who don't answer. I wish I knew of a way around it. The way around it is to send an email to a registered voter list. Some companies are sending a letter in advance. Others are using text-to-web interviews where you get a text message and a link. We're not doing those last two yet, but they may someday be in our future as well.
Thanks for that call, Cynthia, at 800-642-1234. Charles, there's been, some skepticism, about polling starting in 2016 in particular, a sense that Trump voters were undercounted pretty consistently in polls at the state and national level. Are some of these changes, or other changes in polling around the country, reacting to that?
Yes, they are. And that biggest worry in polling is that certain types of voters choose not to respond. If it's highly educated or less educated, we know how to deal with those. The trouble is, what if a certain type of voter, somebody who supports Donald Trump and has particular characteristics, if they won't respond to us, it's very hard to know how to address that question. So one of the things we're doing is looking at the partisan balance in the survey much more closely, and looking at that partisan balance within regions of the state. So that's one step to address it. We've also been looking at the response rate in each county in the state, and whether that's related to the Trump vote in that county in the past, in 2020. Throughout 2022, I'm happy to say that we saw no correlation. Our response rates were about the same in the most pro-Trump counties as they were in the middle counties and as they were in the most anti-Trump counties. So at least by that measure, we're not seeing big biases. Having said all of that, it is a constant worry, and it's one that we'll be working on from now right through the 2024 election. The one advantage of using the registered voter list as opposed to calling phone numbers at random is we do know not how you ever voted in the past, but we do know how often people voted in the past. And so that should also help us with our likely voter model to be able to look at regular voters, occasional voters, and people who are registered but did not participate in 2020, for example, or 2022.
Let's go back to our callers. Jim is with us in Westport. Jim, hi.
Hi. My brother had done polling for years, so I always answer the phone and always try to participate. But one thing I notice is sometimes there may be half a dozen questions. Other times it seems like they go on and on and on and on and on. And the longer the questions are, or the more questions, I feel like I kind of lose interest and might not be a good person. Is there kind of a sweet spot if you ask half a dozen questions versus 12 where you feel you get better data?
Jim, thanks for the call. Charles, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a mixed bag. Some campaign polls will just ask 3, 4, 5 questions and that's it. They just want to get a quick hit and get off. For us, though, it's so expensive to get people on the phone in the first place, right? Those more than 100 calls that don't get answered. And so once we have you on the line, we want to get a variety of opinions. So we ask around 25 to 30 substantive questions, and then we ask a handful of demographic questions like age and education that we need. The result is our total length on a telephone call will be around 15 minutes. A few people go longer than that, but we try really hard not to go past 15. Interestingly, the people that fill out the survey online completed it in something closer to 10 minutes. That may be faster reading speed. It may be the convenience of answering online. It could also just be that the online method flows more quickly. You don't get into a conversation with the interviewer, so you focus on answering the questions and finishing.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Charles Franklin with Marquette University Law School survey, looking at changes in polling in recent years, big changes in the newest poll from Marquette. Charles, I want to talk about the value of different types of polling. First of all, one thing you've done over the years is track Wisconsinites' opinions on a variety of issues. When we ask the same question again and again over the years, what kind of patterns, what kind of changes have stood out to you over the years?
Yeah, there are a few things that have changed quite a bit, but many things have either not changed at all, or they've changed in a very steady pattern over time. So, for example, back in 2012, when we started, support for concealed carry in Wisconsin was a little more unpopular than popular. But support for that has climbed up to in the mid-60s, who now support concealed carry. Support for same-sex marriage rose steadily over time. On the other hand, views of abortion have been quite flat over time. And one in this latest survey, concern about water quality, water safety in your community, and concern specifically about PFAS, the long-lasting chemical that we've seen in a number of communities around the state, concern for those things have gone up each year over the last several years. So you see that people are more concerned about that issue that affects, obviously, the quality of your life and the quality of your drinking water.
With changes in methodology, can we say, okay, surveys after the change, we can compare them reasonably with surveys before the change?
Yeah, we're doing everything we can to make sure that's true. The most difficult part of it is on the telephone, somebody can simply say, well, I just don't know about that, or I haven't thought about that. And an interviewer will then record that person as having said, don't know. But when you're doing the survey online, the options that are presented on the screen are all you can choose from, or you can skip the question entirely. But not nearly as many people skip the question as volunteer that they don't know on the telephone. So one of the things we're looking at is how to calibrate those don't know responses over time. The good news is that's usually not a real big factor, but the bad news is it can matter in certain circumstances. And so we're working on that. I ran every question that we've ever asked before that we asked in June. And I'm happy to say that most of them showed really modest movement. And where we saw big movements, the big movements seem to make sense substantively when you think about the current political environment. Having said all of that, we will be watching for when something looks like it's not consistent with past responses, and we'll either flag that in the poll release or otherwise make some adjustment for it.
And finally, Charles, when people think of polling, they might often think of the election race type polling, candidate A versus candidate B, say. You do that, of course, in your polls. We often, when you're on, get questions of, well, why? Why bother surveying people? The real survey is the election itself. What is the value of doing that kind of polling over time?
Yeah, well, the most important thing is that last I heard, the election won't be held until November of 2024. So do we want to sit around and not know anything about how people are making up their minds about the candidates until election day? I, of course, argue no. We want these snapshots in time of June and October and January and so on. You put enough snapshots together and you get a movie. You get to see how the election developed over time, who rose and who fell. And then at the very end, we get our report card. We get to see how well we did. Was our final poll close to the actual election result? And the good news is, on average, we have been within 2.2 points of the actual result. The bad news is, in 2016, we were off by 6 points. And that was disappointing, to say the least. So don't take any polling for granted, but on the same token, try to use it for that motion picture of where we are today, but over the long haul, how are we developing between now and election day?
Charles, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks so much. Always good to be with you.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director there of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's with us today to talk about changes in polling here in Wisconsin and around the country. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, what will it take for students to catch up if they fell behind on learning goals during the pandemic? Find out how schools are trying to bounce back after the worst pandemic years. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story about optimism.
Learn lessons from our parents, how to cook a traditional family meal, how to have compassion, or how to play an instrument. For Dr. R.F. Ahmed of Madison, his parents taught him about optimism. The writer and cardiologist shares this poem about that lesson.
The Optimist, June 2013, dedicated to my mother Ismat Bano and father Abdul Majid for teaching me optimism. Tough economic times, wars, famine, tsunamis, global meltdown, moral and ethical dehiscence. So is the glass half full or half empty? Enough going on to sap the energies, to drain the enthusiasm. Enough going on to cloud common sense. But wait, it refuses to be a pessimist. It believes in the human will, the human resilience, the human rebound. It believes in the human race to stand up and deliver, every human being to be counted and ask, how can it better another life? How can it make proud Mother Earth? How can it first do no harm? It is the Good Samaritan. It is the human spirit. It is a dreaming child. The question is, can it become I, we, us, yet again?
Dr. R.F. Ahmed shared that writing about optimism, which he wrote in honor of his parents. After recording his poem, he told me a bit more about them.
My mom was a homemaker, and my father was a civil servant. It's interesting, I watched them live optimism. She had cancer, breast cancer, in the 1980s. And it was diagnosed late, and I watched her live her life for years fighting that disease and with great optimism. It never reflected upon me that she was so sick. And then I saw my father. As an individual, I think he is the most transformed individual I have seen, who rose from the lowest ranks of civil service and kept educating himself till he reached the highest ranks. I have not seen a transformation that wide in one person in their lifetime. So I saw a lot of optimism in their living, and that rubbed off of me.
So why do you think it's important to be an optimist?
For our present and for our future. Just like my parents were optimistic through their struggles for me, I believe, like the piece talks about, a dreaming child, which is a great example of optimism. And I once was. I also believe that we hurt our better future when our policies as adults hurt the children, be it the wars or famine or disease or gun violence. And I sometimes envy about a world where we can make policies and we can agree to act upon things which are good for the children everywhere.
How do you pass optimism on to your children?
So I say two things. One, I can't control what comes at me, but I can control how I respond to it. And two, I'm a cardiologist. I know what the science says about optimism, and which is it is critical for mental and physical well-being and for fighting disease. There's also another concept, first do no harm. Being a good Samaritan is great, but sometimes the best thing to do is to first do no harm. This is something we live off in our medical world. That is also a point I wanted to bring up.
Dr. Arif Ahmed is a writer and cardiologist from Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, in most ways, life is pretty much back to normal in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, including the return of in-person schooling for a couple of years now. But many students were affected by the pandemic, and schools are struggling to find ways to recoup years of learning loss related to virtual learning and other challenges. By 2022, the average school district's math score had fallen behind by about half a year. The average student's reading score was about a third of a year behind. That's according to research from Harvard and Stanford universities. And the latest national assessment tests also showed low points in math and reading for 13-year-olds. We're talking about learning loss during the pandemic and how schools around the country are trying to help kids catch up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did virtual learning affect your kids? Are you a student? Do you feel like you're behind? If you work in schools yourself, what kind of things are you seeing among your students? And are there efforts to try to help bridge that gap, to help catch up? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alec McGillis is a reporter at ProPublica, where he covers politics and government. His piece on learning loss appeared in The New Yorker. Alec, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You really zoomed in on a particular public school district in Richmond, Virginia, to illustrate a lot of what a lot of the country's dealing with now. Big picture, what's going on there in Richmond?
Richmond is experiencing learning loss that's even worse than a lot of other parts of the country because they stayed closed especially long. They were closed, entirely closed, for that whole 2021 school year. So their students there did not come back until September of 21, which means that they were out of school, buildings for 18 months, and which put them at the far end of the spectrum in how schools responded. So they're dealing there with test scores that have fallen even more than elsewhere. Students that are dealing with even more severe kind of social emotional learning issues, lots of issues with violence in the schools. And so they're really recognizing that they're really up against it and have been debating about how they should respond. And there's been a really interesting 2-year-long debate there over what they should do. And what the debate has come down to is whether they should somehow expand the school year, expand the amount of instructional time that students are getting in order to make up some of that lost ground.
And while Richmond may have seen the worst of it in some ways, they're not alone in asking these questions, right? Can you talk a little bit about what we saw nationwide when it came to test scores, learning, social development after school closures?
Nationwide, it's been incredible. You talk to the experts in the field, the education researchers, the economists, and they're kind of stunned by how dire the situation is right now. And it's not really being reflected in the national coverage of this issue, the way we're talking about this. It's to me, it's really one reason I set out to do the story was that it was striking how little attention was going to this, what is really an epochal crisis. I mean, students' livelihoods are going to be affected, you know, for throughout their lifespans, unless there's some more dramatic action taken in this country. Our income, our lifelong earning potential is very closely tied to learning achievement, to skills, even more than in much of the rest of the world. And so the economists warn that these students, this cohort of students and the communities in which they reside are going to see actual, you know, real hits to their economic livelihood and their, you know, life fulfillment, really, as a result of these really steep drops. And it's not just drops for everyone. That's the key. We're seeing a huge growth in disparities. We had actually managed to close our racial disparities in education somewhat over recent decades. And we've made some real ground in that regard. And all of a sudden now we've just seen those disparities blow wide open again. It's really, really worrisome just how much of a reversal there's been in that regard.
I wanted to ask you more about that, Alec. What was it about virtual learning? Maybe it's obvious people had less or more access to the internet and home resources. What was it about that whole experience that seemed to widen those inequities again?
There are several factors, but that the overriding one that the researchers are now pointing to is that there's a pretty strong correlation between the extent of learning loss, the extent of these drop-offs in learning achievement, this lost ground, and the length of closures, pandemic school closures in various parts of the country. Various states and cities responded in different ways, and the places that kept school buildings closed the longest, stuck with virtual learning the longest, such as Richmond, Virginia, have experienced, by and large, the steepest drop-offs in achievement. And to the extent that those closures were especially long in our big cities in blue states, where a lot of Black and Hispanic students reside, you are now seeing their numbers suffering accordingly, with, you know, especially steep drop-offs. So that really is most likely the biggest reason for this very concerning growth in disparity.
We're talking to ProPublica reporter Alec McGillis about his recent article, "Can America's Students Recover What They Lost During the Pandemic?" It appeared in The New Yorker. You can see it on the ProPublica website as well. You could join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue in your school district, in your own family? Did you see your own kid maybe fall behind some during the pandemic when it came to learning? What kind of things are, if any, are helping if you work in schools? Are there things that your district is doing to try to help kids play catch up if they need to? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll look at some possible solutions, some challenges to solving this. You could join in, and we'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with ProPublica's Alec McGillis about his recent article, "Can America's Students Recover What They Lost During the Pandemic?" Looking at learning loss during the pandemic, efforts in schools around the country to help kids catch up. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think would most help students and teachers deal with pandemic-related learning loss? What solutions do you see? What are you seeing in your own schools, maybe in your own family? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Alec, earlier you mentioned, you know, Richmond looking at maybe a year-round schooling, other thoughts about ways to expand educational time one way or the other. What kind of solutions are people floating out there for this?
There has been a lot of federal money sent to the schools during and after the pandemic to try to deal with this crisis. In total, about $190 billion has gone to school districts to deal with various aspects of the pandemic fallout. And some of the things that districts are using this money for include intensive tutoring sessions with students, extended day programs, so adding an hour or so at the end of the school day, and some kind of expanded summer school. The challenge has been, the biggest challenge has been that we're suffering a teacher shortage in a lot of districts, and this extends to tutoring. It's really difficult to find people to do this intensive tutoring that's been found to be, if it's done right, found to be quite successful. That's one big challenge. And the reason that Richmond and a few other districts have looked at extending the school year calendar is that is a way to address this problem in a way that doesn't require getting more other staff. You basically are using the staff you have. You're simply going to be paying them more to basically teach more days during the school year, and you're taking what we already have in terms of regular school and basically just extending it to try to make up some of that lost ground. And the researchers say that this is probably the most effective way to deal with this huge crisis that we're now facing.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hey, Rob. All due deference to the guest. As a classroom teacher going through the pandemic, we found out the hard way that so much of teaching is just so face-to-face. It's the personal connection that makes the difference. Also, our curriculum is 2 to 3 years too advanced for what is appropriate childhood developmental levels. Talk to people that are 70 years old. The things we learned in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade back then, they're teaching that now in 3rd grade. Why are we pushing kids so hard, so early, so young to succeed where that's where the struggle is? I think if we had more reasonable expectations for what is good for kids at the correct age, we wouldn't see this learning loss. And hey, parents, while we're at it, back up your school, back up your teacher, tell your kids to do their homework and tell them to unplug from their device.
Kevin, can I ask before I let you go, what yeah. grade do you teach?
I've been teaching 6th through 8th middle school for about 25 years.
Okay, so you're right in that standardized testing age that's been out there in the news lately. I mean, do you feel like your kids post-pandemic are struggling more than they did pre-pandemic, or not as much change as we're seeing in the news in your classroom?
What I'm seeing is a generation that has totally taken the wrong message from No Child Left Behind. Well, I'm a year older. I don't have to do anything. I get to go to the next grade because you can't leave me behind. We are also holding schools and teachers accountable to 12-year-olds who are not invested in necessarily showing us all that they can do.
Gotcha. Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there, Alec. First of all, I mean, I don't think you'd argue with this point about face-to-face teaching being more valuable, but the higher expectations he sees out there for current students. What do you think?
Well, what really struck me in the caller's comments was his mention of the devices, and that's something I'm hearing about from so many teachers now, the challenge that's presented by, particularly by phones in the classroom and students being distracted by them, and that's just becoming a huge issue. And it's actually something that people point to when they note that we did see pre-pandemic, we started to see a flattening of scores of our, we had seen general growth in scores over the decades. And then we saw a definite flattening starting, and even some dips starting around, 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14 in that period. And there's been some surmising that is connected to the invasion of the classroom by just device distraction. As far as the higher standards, I can certainly see the caller's point. There's also, at the same time, there's been an interesting shift in the debate around standards, where when you raise this issue now of the pandemic learning loss, you are definitely seeing some of a sort of rhetorical move, especially kind of on the left, among progressive Americans, to kind of actually questioning the whole notion of standards. This notion that standardized tests are biased. We should not be basing too much on standardized tests. Students are learning in other ways that don't show up in standardized tests. And there's definitely been somewhat of a general shakiness of assumptions around standardized testing and how should learning be assessed and scored, and that's actually kind of made it somewhat hard to now muster real alarm around this huge pandemic learning loss, because even before the pandemic there was starting to be somewhat of a move away from the expectations and standards that we had kind of built up around standardized testing. And that really, I think, is one reason we're not seeing as much urgency as we probably should be around this current crisis.
Kevin, thanks for the call. We'll go to Kate now in Platteville. Kate, hi.
Hi. I feel like the previous call just kind of started to bring some of my question, started to speak to some of my question, and that is, how confident are we that these issues really are corollary with the pandemic, or if what we really should be looking at is, while the pandemic certainly didn't help the situation, should we be looking at some other pretty major causes of these learning declines?
Kate, I got you. We don't have a lot of time left. Alec, what do you think?
There are other issues out there, including the cell phones in classroom one that I just mentioned, but it's pretty clear when you look at the numbers that we've suffered incredibly dramatic drop-offs that correlate exactly with the year plus of closures in a lot of districts around the country. And so there just clearly was just a massive declines tied to the lack of in-person instructional time, all that time that students lost. And the question is how to now make that up.
Okay, thanks for the call. Just in our last minute, Alec, you mentioned it seems like there's some ways we're pretty sure to help these kids. They involve more time. They involve teachers who may not exist because of a teacher shortage. Are you seeing efforts that can overcome that challenge and give these kids the extra instructional time they might need?
Yes. I mean, what I found inspiring was in Richmond that there were a couple schools that now are going to be starting a month early this summer. They got the approval for a pilot program there. That the effort to do this district-wide fell apart for reasons that I described in the piece, a lot of resistance from various quarters in town. But at these couple schools, elementary schools, they're going to be starting on July 24th this month, a month early, schools that fell especially far behind with a lot of disadvantaged students. And it's going to be really interesting to see what these schools are able to do with that extra time to make up that lost ground.
Alec, thanks a lot for sharing your reporting with us today.
Thank you.
That's Alec McGillis, reporter at ProPublica, where he covers politics and government. He talked to us about his recent reporting on pandemic-related learning loss. You can read more. We'll get a link to his article up at WPR.org/Central Time.